But I could not bear for you to hit me. She threw her arms around him, kissed his cheeks. Forgive me, forgive me. Sir Kevin suffered the embrace for a few heartbeats before he finally raised his own arms to return it. His hug was short and awkward. Enough, he said, his voice still flat and cold. You are forgiven. Now sit. I bring some hard tidings, Cersei. His words frightened her. Has something happened to Tommen? Oh, please, no. I have been so afraid for my son. No one will tell me anything. Please tell me that Tommen is well. His Grace is well. He asked about you often. Sir Kevin laid his hands on her shoulders. He held her at arm's length.
Jamie, then. Is it Jamie?
No, Jamie is still in the Riverland somewhere.
Somewhere?
She did not like the sound of that. He took Raventree and accepted Lord Blackwood's surrender, said her uncle. But on his way back to Riverrun, he left his tail and went off with a woman.
A woman? Cersei stared at him, uncomprehending. What woman? Why? Where did they go?
No one knows. We had no further word of him. The woman may have been the Evanstar's daughter, Lady Brienne.
Her?
The Queen remembered the Maid of Tarth, a huge, ugly, shambling thing who dressed in man's mail.
Jamie would never abandon me for such a creature. My raven never reached him. Elsewise, he would have come.
We've had reports of sellswords landing all over the south, Sir Kevin was saying. Tarth, the Stepstones, Cape Wrath. Where Stannis found the coin to hire a free company, I would dearly love to know. I do not have the strength to deal with them, not here. Mace Tyrell does, but he refuses to bestir himself until this matter with his daughter has been settled.
A headsman would settle Margaery quick enough.
Cersei did not care a fig for Stannis or his sellswords.
The others take him, and the Tyrells both. Let them slaughter each other. The realm will be the better for it.
Please, uncle, take me out of here.
How? By force of arms?
Sir Kevin walked to the window and gazed out frowning. I would need to make an abattoir of this holy place, and I do not have the men. The best part of our forces was at Riverrun, your brother. I had no time to raise a new host. He turned back to face her. I have spoken with His High Holiness. He will not release you until you have atoned for your sins.
I have confessed.
Atoned, I said. Before the city. A walk.
No.
She knew what her uncle was about to say, and she did not want to hear it.
Never. Tell him that, if you speak to him again. I am a queen, not some duckside whore.
No harm would come to you. No one would touch.
No, she said more sharply. I would sooner die.
Sir Kevin was unmoved. If that is your wish, you may soon have it granted. His High Holiness is resolved that you be tried for regicide, deicide, incest, and high treason.
Deicide?
She almost laughed.
When did I kill a god?
The High Septon speaks for the Septon here on Earth. Strike at him, and you're striking at the gods themselves. Her uncle raised a hand before she could protest. It does no good to speak of such things. Not here. The time for all that is at trial. He gazed about her cell. The look on his face spoke volumes.
Someone is listening.
Even here, even now, she dare not speak freely. She took a breath.
Who will try me?
The faith, her uncle said, unless you insist on a trial by battle, in which case you must be championed by a knight of the King's Guard. Whatever the outcome, your rule is at an end. I will serve as Tommen's regent until he comes of age. Mace Tyrell has been named King's Hand. Grand Maester Pycelle and Sir Harris Swift will continue as before. But Paxter Redwine is now Lord Admiral, and Randall Tarly has assumed the duties of Justiciar.
Tyrell Bannerman? The both of them.
The whole governance of the realm was being handed to her enemies. Queen Marjorie's kith and kin. Marjorie sends accused as well. Her and those cousins of hers, how is it that the sparrows freed her and not me?
Grendel Tarly insisted. He was the first to reach King's Landing when this storm broke, and he brought his army with him. The Tyrell girls will still be tried, but the case against them is weak. His High Holiness admits. All of the men named as the Queen's lovers have denied the accusation, or recanted, save for your maimed singer, who appears to be half mad. So the High Septon handed the girls over to Tarly's custody, and Lord Randall swore a holy oath to deliver them for trial when the time comes.
And her accusers? The Queen demanded. Who holds them?
Osney Kettleblack and the Blue Bard are here, beneath the sept. The Red Wine Twins have been declared innocent, and Hamish the Harper has died. The rest are in the dungeons under the Red Keep, in the charge of your man, Qyburn.
Qyburn, thought Cersei. That was good. One straw, at least, that she could clutch. Lord Qyburn had them, and Lord Qyburn could do wonders.
And horrors. He can do horrors as well. There is more. Worse. Will you sit down?
Sit down?
Cersei shook her head. What could be worse? She was to be tried for high treason, whilst the little queen and her cousins flew off, as free as birds.
Tell me, what is it?
Miss Heller, we have had grave news from Dawn.
Tyrion, she said at once.
Tyrion had sent her little girl to Dawn, and Cersei had dispatched Sir Balin Swan to bring her home. All Dornishmen were snakes, and the Martells were the worst of them. The Red Viper had even tried to defend the imp, had come within a hair's breadth of a victory that would have allowed the dwarf to escape the blame for Joffrey's murder.
It's him. He's been in Dawn all this time, and now he sees my daughter.
Sir Kevin gave her another scowl.
Marcella was attacked by a Dornish knight named Gerald Dane.
She's alive, but hurt. He slashed her face open, and she, I'm sorry, she lost an ear.
An ear?
Cersei stared at him aghast.
She was just a child, my precious princess. She was so pretty, too. He cut off her ear?
And Prince Doran and his Dornish knights, where were they?
They could not defend one little girl. Where was Ares O'Cart?
Slain, defending her. Dane cut him down, it said. The Sword of the Morning had been a Dane, the Queen recalled, but he was long dead. Who was this Sir Gerald, and why would he wish to harm her daughter? She could not make any sense of this, unless...
Tyrion lost half his nose in the Battle of the Blackwater, slashing her face, cutting off an ear. The imp's grubby little fingers are all over this.
Prince Doran says nothing of your brother, and Balon Swan writes of this Marcella, puts it all on this Gerald Dane. Darkstar, they call him. She gave a bitter laugh. Whatever they call him, he is my brother's catspaw. Tyrion has friends amongst the Dornish. The imp planned this all along. It was Tyrion who betrothed Mycella to Prince Trysane.
Now I see why.
You see Tyrion in every shadow. He is a creature of the shadows. He killed Joffrey. He killed father.
Did you think he would stop there? I feared that the imp was still in King's Landing, plotting harm to Tommen. But he must have gone to Dawn instead, to kill Marcella first.
Cersei paced the width of the cell.
I need to be with Tommen. These Kingsguard's knights are as useless as nipples on a breastplate.
She rounded on her uncle.
Sir Ares was killed, you said?
At the hands of this man Darkstar, yes.
Dead. He's dead. Are you certain of that?
That is what we have been told.
Then there is an empty place amongst the King's Guard. It must be filled at once. Tommen must be protected.
Lord Tarley is drawing up a list of worthy knights for your brother to consider. But until Jamie reappears...
The king can give a man a white cloak. Tommen's a good boy. Tell him whom to name, and he will name him.
And whom would you have him name?
She did not have a ready answer.
My champion will need a new name, as well as a new face. Caiban will know. Trust him in this. You and I have had our differences, uncle, but for the blood we share, and the love you bore my father, for Tommen's sake and the sake of his poor maimed sister, do as I ask you. Go to Lord Caiban, on my behalf. Bring him a white cloak, and tell him that the time has come.
The Queen's Guard.
You were the Queen's men, said Resnick Mo Resnick. The King desires his own men about him when he holds court.
I am the Queen's man still, today, tomorrow, always, until my last breath or hers.
Barristan Selmy refused to believe that Daenerys Targaryen was dead.
Perhaps that was why he was being put aside. One by one, his dower removes us all.
Strong Belwas lingered at the door of death in the temple, under the care of the Blue Graces, though Selmy half suspected they were finishing the job those honeyed locusts had begun.
Scarhaz Shavepate had been stripped of his command. The Unsullied had withdrawn to their barracks. Jogo, Dario Naharis, Admiral Grolio, and Hero of the Unsullied remained hostages of the Yunkai. Aggo and Ricaro and the rest of the Queen's Khalasar had been dispatched across the river to search for their lost queen. Even Missandei had been replaced. The king did not think it fit to use a child as his herald, and a one-time Na'vi slave at that.
And now me. There was a time when he might have taken this dismissal as a blot upon his honour, but that was in Westeros. In the viper's pit that was Meereen, honour seemed as silly as a fool's motley. And this mistrust was mutual. His Dar Zolorek might be his queen's consort, but he would never be his king.
If his grace wishes for me to remove myself from court, his radiance, the seneschal corrected. No, 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 you misunderstand me. His worship is to receive a delegation from the Yunkai to discuss the withdrawal of their armies. They may ask for recompense for those who lost their lives to the dragon's wrath. A delicate situation. The king feels it will be better if they see a Meereenese king upon the throne, protected by Meereenese warriors. Surely you can understand that, sir.
I understand more than you know. Might I know which men His Grace has chosen to protect him?
Resnick Mo Resnick smiled his slimy smile. Fearsome fighters who love his worship well. Gogor the giant, Kras the spotted cap, Bellaquo bonebreaker, heroes all.
Pit fighters all?
Sir Barrister was unsurprised. His Dar Zolorek sat uneasily on his new throne. It had been 1,000 years since Meereen last had a king, and there were some, even amongst the old blood, who thought they might have made a better choice than him. Outside the city sat the Yunkai, with their sellswords and their allies. Inside were the sons of the Harpy. And the king's protectors grew fewer every day. His Dar's blunder with Grey Worm had cost him the Unsullied. When His Grace had tried to put them under the command of a cousin, as he had the Brazen Beasts, Grey Worm had informed the king that they were free men who took commands only from their mother. As for the Brazen Beasts, half were freedmen and the rest shavepates, whose true loyalty might still be to Skahaz Mokandek. The pit fighters were King Hisdar's only reliable support against a sea of enemies.
May they defend His Grace against all threats. Sir Barristan's tone gave no hint
of his true feelings. He had learned to hide such back in King's Landing years ago. "His magnificence," Resnick Mo Resnick stressed. "Your other duties shall remain unchanged, sir. Should this peace fail, His Radiance would still wish for you to command his forces against the enemies of our city."
"He has that much sense, at least."
Bellicor Bonebreaker and Gogor the Giant might serve as Hesdar's shields, but the notion of either leading an army into battle was so ludicrous that the old knight almost smiled.
"I am His Grace's to command."
"Not Grace," the Seneschal complained. "That style is Westerosi. His Magnificence, His Radiance, His Worship."
"His Vanity would fit better." "As you say." Resnick licked his lips.
"Then we are done."
This time his oily smile betokened dismissal. Sir Barristan took his leave, grateful to leave the stench of the Seneschal's perfume behind him.
"A man should smell of sweat, not flowers."
The Great Pyramid of Meereen was 800 feet high from base to point. The Seneschal's chambers were on the second level. The Queen's apartments and his own occupied the highest step.
"A long climb for a man my age," Sir Barristan thought, as he started up.
He had been known to make that climb 5 or 6 times a day on the Queen's business, as the aches in his knees and the small of his back could attest.
"There will come a day when I can no longer face these steps," he thought, "and that day will be here sooner than I would like."
Before it came, he must make certain that at least a few of his lads were ready to take his place at the Queen's side.
"I will knight them myself when they are worthy, and give them each a horse and golden spurs."
The royal apartments were still and silent. Hisdar had not taken up residence there, preferring to establish his own suite of rooms deep in the heart of the Great Pyramid, where massive brick walls surrounded him on all sides. Mizara Miklas and Kezar, and the rest of the Queen's young cupbearers, hostages in truth, but both Selmy and the Queen had become so fond of them that it was hard for him to think of them that way, had gone with the King, whilst Eri and Jiqui departed with the other Dothraki. Only Missandei remained, a forlorn little ghost haunting the Queen's chambers at the apex of the pyramid. Sir Barristan walked out onto the terrace. The sky above Meereen was the colour of corpse flesh, dull and white and heavy, a mass of unbroken cloud from horizon to horizon. The sun was hidden behind a wall of cloud. It would set unseen, as it had risen unseen that morning. The night would be hot, a sweaty, suffocating, sticky sort of night, without a breath of air. For 3 days rain had threatened, but not a drop had fallen.
"Rain would come as a relief. It might help wash the city clean."
From here he could see 4 lesser pyramids, the city's western walls, and the camps of the Yunkish men by the shores of Slaver's Bay, where a thick column of greasy smoke twisted upwards like some monstrous serpent.
"Ah, the Yunkish men burning their dead," he realized. "A pale mare is galloping through their siege camps."
Despite all the Queen had done, the sickness had spread both within the city walls and without. Meereen's markets were closed, its streets empty. King Hisdar had allowed the fighting pits to remain open, but the crowds were sparse. The Meereenese had even begun to shun the Temple of the Graces, reportedly.
"The slavers will find some way to blame Daenerys for that as well,"
Sir Barristan thought bitterly. He could almost hear them whispering, great masters, sons of the Harpy, Yunkai, all telling one another that his queen was dead. Half of the city believed it, though as yet they did not have the courage to say such words aloud.
"But soon, I think."
Sir Barristan felt very tired, very old.
Where have all the years gone?
Of late, whenever he knelt to drink from a still pool, he saw a stranger's face gazing up from the water's depths. When had those crow's feet first appeared around his pale blue eyes? How long ago had his hair turned from sunlight into snow?
Years ago, old man, decades.
Yet it seemed like only yesterday that he had been raised to knighthood after the tourney at King's Landing. He could still recall the touch of King Aegon's sword upon his shoulder, light as a maiden's kiss. His words had caught in his throat when he spoke his vows. At the feast that night, he had eaten ribs of wild boar, prepared the Dornish way with dragon peppers, so hot they burned his mouth. 47 years, and the taste still lingered in his memory. Yet he could not have said what he supped on 10 days ago if all 7 kingdoms had depended on it.
Boiled dog? Most like. Or some other foul dish that tasted no better?
Not for the first time, Selmy wondered at the strange fates that had brought him here. He was a knight of Westeros, a man of the Stormlands and the Dornish Marches. His place was in the 7 kingdoms, not here, upon the sweltering shores of Slaver's Bay.
I came to bring Daenerys home.
Yet he had lost her, just as he had lost her father and her brother.
Even Robert, I failed him too.
Perhaps Hisdar was wiser than he knew.
10 years ago, I would have sensed what Daenerys meant to do. 10 years ago, I would have been quick enough to stop her.
Instead, he had stood befuddled as she leapt into the pit, shouting her name, then running uselessly after her across the scarlet sands.
I am become old and slow.
Small wonder Naharis mocked him as Sir Grandfather.
Would Dario have moved more quickly if he had been beside the queen that day?
Selmy thought he knew the answer to that, although it was not one he liked. He had dreamed of it again last night. Belwas on his knees, retching up bile and blood, Hisdar urging on the dragon slayers, men and women fleeing in terror, fighting on the steps, climbing over one another, screaming and shouting, and Daenerys.
Her hair was aflame. She had the whip in her hand, and she was shouting. Then she was on the dragon's back, flying.
The sand that Drogon stirred as he took wing had stung Sir Barristan's eyes. But through a veil of tears, he had watched the beast fly from the pit, his great black wings slapping at the shoulders of the bronze warriors at the gates. The rest he learned later. Beyond the gates had been a solid press of people. Maddened by the smell of dragon, horses below reared in terror, lashing out with iron-shod hooves. Food stalls and palanquins alike were overturned, men knocked down and trampled. Spears were thrown, crossbows were fired. Some struck home. The dragon twisted violently in the air, wounds smoking, the girl clinging to his back. Then he loosed the fire. It had taken the rest of the day and most of the night for the brazen beasts to gather up the corpses. The final count was 214 slain, 3 times as many burned or wounded. Drogon was gone from the city by then, last seen high over the Skahazadan, flying north. Of Daenerys Targaryen, no trace had been found. Some swore they had seen her fall. Others insisted that the dragon had carried her off to devour her.
They are wrong.
Sir Barristan knew no more of dragons than the tales every child hears, but he knew Targaryens. Daenerys had been riding that dragon, as Aegon had once ridden Balerion of old.
"She might be flying home," he told himself aloud.
"No," murmured a soft voice behind him. "She would not do that, sir. She would not go home without us."
Sir Barristan turned.
"Missandei, Child, how long have you been standing there?
Not long. This one is sorry if she has disturbed you.
She hesitated.
Skaha's Mokandak wishes words with you.
The shave pit. You spoke with him?
Oh, that was rash, rash.
The enmity ran deep between Skaha's and the king, and the girl was clever enough to know that. Skaha's had been outspoken in his opposition to the queen's marriage, a fact Hisdar had not forgotten.
Is he here, in the pyramid? When he wishes, he comes and goes, sir. Yes, he would.
Who told you he wants words with me?
A brazen beast. He wore an owl mask.
He wore an owl mask when he spoke to you. By now he could be a jackal, a tiger, a sloth.
Sir Barrison had hated the mask from the start, and never more than now. Honest men should never need to hide their faces. And the shave pate?
What could he be thinking?
After Hisdar had given command of the brazen beast to his cousin, Margaz Zolorek, Skarhaz had been named warden of the river, with charge of all the ferries, dredges, and irrigation ditches along the Skarhazadan for 50 leagues. But the shave-pate had refused that ancient and honourable office, as Hisdar called it, preferring to retire to the modest pyramid of Kandak.
Without the queen to protect him, he takes a great risk coming here.
And if Sir Barristan were seen speaking with him, suspicion might fall on the knight as well. He did not like the taste of this. It smelled of deceit, of whispers and lies and plots, hatched in the dark. All the things he hoped to leave behind with the spider and Lord Littlefinger and their ilk. Barristan Selmy was not a bookish man, but he had often glanced through the pages of the White Book, where the deeds of his predecessors had been recorded. Some had been heroes, some weaklings, knaves or cravens. Most were only men, quicker and stronger than most, more skilled with sword and shield, but still prey to pride, ambition, lust, love, anger, jealousy, greed for gold, hunger for power, and all the other failings that afflicted lesser mortals. The best of them overcame their flaws, did their duty, and died with their swords in their hands. The worst?
The worst were those who played the Game of Thrones.
"Can you find this owl again?" he asked Miss Andy.
"This one can try, sir. Tell him I will speak with our friend, after dark, by the stables."
The pyramid's main doors were closed and barred at sunset. The stables would be quiet at that hour.
"Make certain it is the same owl."
It would not serve to have the wrong brazen beast hear of this.
"This one understands."
Miss Andy turned as if to go, then paused for a moment and said,
"It is said that the Yunkai have ringed the city all about with scorpions to loose iron bolts into the sky should Drogon return."
Sir Barristan had heard that too.
"It is no simple thing to slay a dragon in the sky. In Westeros, many tried to bring down Aegon and his sisters. None succeeded."
Miss Andy nodded. It was hard to tell if she was reassured.
"Do you think that they will find her, sir? The grasslands are so vast, and dragons leave no tracks across the sky. Aego and Ricaro are blood of her blood. And who knows they Dothraki see better than Dothraki?"
He squeezed her shoulder.
"They will find her, if she can be found. If she still lives."
There were other carles who prowled the grass, horse lords with khalasars whose riders numbered in the tens of thousands. But the girl did not need to hear that.
"You love her well, I know. I swear I shall keep her safe."
The words seemed to give the girl some comfort.
"Words are wind, though," Sir Barristan thought. "How can I protect the queen when I am not with her?"
Barristan Selmy had known many kings. He had been born during the troubled reign of Aegon the Unlikely, beloved by the common folk, had received his knighthood at his hands. Aegon's son Jaehaerys had bestowed the white cloak on him when he was 23, after he slew Maelys the Monstrous during the War of the Ninepenny Kings. In that same cloak he had stood beside the Iron Throne as madness consumed Jaehaerys' son Aerys.
Stood and saw and heard, and yet did nothing.
But no, that was not fair. He did his duty. Some nights the Barristan wondered if he had not done that duty too well. He had sworn his vows before the eyes of gods and men. He could not in honour go against them. But the keeping of those vows had grown hard in the last years of King Aerys' reign. He had seen things that it pained him to recall, and more than once he wondered how much of the blood was on his own hands. If he had not gone into Duskendale to rescue Aerys from Lord Darkland's dungeons, the king might well have died there, as Tywin Lannister sacked the town. Then Prince Rhaegar would have ascended the Iron Throne, mayhaps to heal the realm. Duskendale had been his finest hour, yet the memory tasted bitter on his tongue. It was his failures that haunted him at night, though. Jaehaerys, Aerys, Robert, three dead kings. Rhaegar, who would have been a finer king than any of them. Princess Elia and the children. Aegon, just a babe. Rhaenys with her kitten. Dead, everyone. Yet he still lived, who had sworn to protect them. And now Daenerys, his bright, shining child queen.
She is not dead. I will not believe it.
Afternoon brought Sir Barristan a brief respite from his doubts. He spent it in the training hall on the pyramid's third level, working with his boys, teaching them the art of sword and shield, horse and lance, and chivalry. The code that made a knight more than any pit-fighter. Daenerys would need protectors her own age about her after he was gone, and Sir Barristan was determined to give her such. The lads he was instructing ranged in age from 8 to 20. He had started with more than 60 of them, but the training had proved too rigorous for many. Less than half that number now remained, but some showed great promise.
"With no king to guard, I will have more time to train them now," he realized,
as he walked from pair to pair, watching them go at one another with blunted swords and spears with rounded heads.
"Brave boys, base-born, aye, but some will make good knights, and they love the queen. If not for her, all of them would have ended in the pits. King Hesdar has his pit-fighters, but Daenerys will have knights. Keep your shield up," he called. "Show me your strokes. Together now, low, high, low, low, high, low."
Selmy took his simple supper out onto the Queen's terrace that night and ate it as the sun went down. Through the purple twilight, he watched fires waken one by one in the great stepped pyramids, as the many-colored bricks of Meereen faded to gray and then to black. Shadows gathered in the streets and alleys below, making pools and rivers. In the dusk, the city seemed a tranquil place, even beautiful.
"That is pestilence, not peace," the old knight told himself, with his last sip of wine.
He did not wish to be conspicuous, so when he was finished with his supper, he changed out of his court clothes, trading the white cloak of the Queen's Guard for a hooded brown traveller's cloak, such as any common man might wear. He kept his sword and dagger.
This could still be some trap.
He had little trust in Hesdar, and less in Resnek Mo Resnek. The perfumed seneschal could well be part of this, trying to lure him into a secret meeting, so he could sweep up him and Skahas both, and charge them with conspiring against the king.
"If the shave-pate speaks treason, he will leave me no choice but to arrest him. Hisdar is my queen's consort. however little I may like it. My duty is to him, not Skaha's.
Or was it?
The first duty of the king's guard was to defend the king from harm or threat. The White Knights were sworn to obey the king's commands as well, to keep his secrets, counsel him when counsel was requested, and keep silent when it was not, serve his pleasure and defend his name and honour. Strictly speaking, it was purely the king's choice whether or not to extend king's guard protection to others, even those of royal blood. Some kings thought it right and proper to dispatch king's guard to serve and defend their wives and children, siblings, aunts, uncles, and cousins of greater and lesser degree, and occasionally even their lovers, mistresses, and bastards. But others preferred to use household knights and men-at-arms for those purposes, whilst keeping their seven as their own personal guards, never far from their sides.
If the queen had commanded me to protect Hisdar, I would have had no choice but to obey.
But Daenerys Targaryen had never established a proper queen's guard, even for herself, nor issued any commands in respect to her consort.
The world was simpler when I had a lord commander to decide such matters, Selmy reflected. Now I am the lord commander, and it is hard to know which path is right.
When at last he came to the bottom of the last flight of steps, he found himself all but alone amongst the torch-lit corridors inside the pyramid's massive brick walls. The great gates were closed and barred, as he had anticipated. Four brazen beasts stood guard outside those doors, four more within. It was those that the old knight encountered, big men, masters Boar, Bear, Vole, and Manticore.
"All quiet, sir,"
the bear told him.
"Keep it so."
It was not unknown for Sir Barristan to walk around at night to make certain the pyramid was secure. Deeper inside the pyramid, another four brazen beasts had been set to guard the iron doors outside the pit where Viserion and Rhaegal were chained. The light of the torches shimmered off their masks, ape, ram, wolf, crocodile.
"Have they been fed?"
Sir Barristan asked.
"Aye, sir," replied the ape. "A sheep apiece."
"And how long will that suffice, I wonder?"
As the dragons grew, so did their appetites. It was time to find the shave-pate. Sir Barristan made his way past the elephants and the queen's silver mare to the back of the stables. An ass nickered as he went by, and a few of the horses stirred at the light of his lantern. Elsewise, all was dark and silent. Then a shadow detached itself from inside an empty stall and became another brazen beast, clad in pleated black skirt, greaves, and muscled breastplate.
"A cat," said Barristan Selmy, when he saw the brass beneath the hood. When the shave-pate had commanded the brazen beast, he had favoured a serpent's head mask, imperious and frightening.
"Cats go everywhere,"
replied the familiar voice of Skaha's Mokandak.
"No one ever looks at them."
"If Hisdar should learn that you are here..."
"Who would tell him? Margaz? Margaz knows what I want him to know. The beasts are still mine. Do not forget it."
The shave-pate's voice was muffled by his mask, but Selmy could hear the anger in it.
"I have the poisoner."
"Who?"
"Hisdar's confectioner. His name would mean nothing to you. The man was just a cat's paw. The sons of the Arpi took his daughter, and swore she would be returned unarmed once the queen was dead. Belmars and the dragon saved Daenerys. No one saved the girl. She was returned to her father in the Black of Night, in 9 pieces, one for every year she lived."
"Why?"
Doubts gnawed at him. The sons had stopped their killing. Hisdar's peace
is a sham. Not at first, no. The Yunkai were afraid of our queen, of her unsullied, of her dragons. This land has known dragons before. Yurkaz O'Yunzek had read his histories, he knew. His jar as well. Why not a piece? Daenerys wanted it, they could see that. Wanted it too much. She should have marched to Astapor.
Scar has moved closer.
That was before. The pit changed all. Daenerys gone. Yerkaz dead. In place of one old lion, a pack of jackals. Bloodbeard. That one has no taste for peace. And there is more, worse. Volantis has launched its fleet against us.
Volantis? Selma's sword hand tingled. We made a peace with Yunkai, not with Volantis. You are certain?
Certain. The wise masters know. So do their friends. The Arpi, Resnak, Hizdar. This king will open the city gates to the Volantines when they arrive. All those Daenerys freed will be enslaved again. Even some who were never slaves will be fitted for chains. You may end your days in a fighting pit, old man. Kras will eat your heart.
His head was pounding. Daenerys must be told.
Find her first.
Skarhaz grasped his forearm. His fingers felt like iron.
We cannot wait for her. I've spoken with the Free Brothers, the Mother's Men, the stalwart shields. They have no trust in Lorik. We must break the Yunkai, but we need the Unsullied. Grey Worm will listen to you. Speak to him.
To what end? He is speaking treason, conspiracy.
Life.
The Shavepate's eyes were black pools behind the brazen cat mask.
We must strike before Volantines arrive. Break the siege. Kill the slaver lords. Turn their sellswords. The Yunkai do not expect an attack. I have spies in their camps. Their sickness, they say, worse every day. Discipline has gone to rot. The lords are drunk more often than not, gorging themselves at feasts, telling each other of the riches they'll divide when Meereen falls, squabbling over primacy. Bloodbeard and the Tattered Prince despise each other. No one expects a fight, not now. Hizdar's peace has lulled us to sleep, they believe.
Daenerys signed that peace,
Sir Barristan said.
It is not for us to break it without her leave.
And if she is dead?
Demanded Skarhaz.
What answer? I say she would want us to protect her city, her children.
Her children were the freedmen. Mysa, they called her, all those whose chains she broke. Mother.
The Shavepate was not wrong. Daenerys would want her children protected.
What of Hizdar? He is still her consort, her king, her husband.
Her poisoner.
Is he? Where is your proof?
The crown he wears is proof enough. The throne he sits. Open your eyes, old man. That is all he needed from Daenerys. All he ever wanted. Once he had it, why share the rule?
Why, indeed?
It had been so hot down in the pit. He could still see the air shimmering above the scarlet sands, smell the blood spilling from the men who died for their amusement. And he could still hear Hizdar urging his queen to try the honeyed locust.
Those are very tasty, sweet and hot. Yet he never touched so much as one himself.
Selmy rubbed his temple.
I swore no vows to Hizdar Zolorek, and if I had, he has cast me aside, just as Joffrey did. This confectioner, I want to question him myself, alone.
Is it that way?
The Shavepate crossed his arms against his chest.
Done, then. Question him as you like.
If what he has to say convinces me, if I join with you in I would require your word that no harm would come to Hizdar Zolorek unless it can be proved that he had some part in this.
Why do you care so much for Hizdar, old man? If he is not the Arpi, he is the Arpi's firstborn son.
All I know for certain is that he is the Queen's consort. I want your word on this, or I swear I shall oppose you." Scarha's smile was savage.
"My word, then. No harm to Hisdar till his guilt is proved. But when we have the proof, I mean to kill him with my own hands. I want to pull his entrails out and show them to him before I let him die."
No, the old knight thought. If Hisdar conspired at my queen's death, I will see to him myself. But his death will be swift and clean. The guards of Westeros were far away, yet Sir Barristan Selmy paused for a moment to say a silent prayer, asking the crone to light his way to wisdom. "For the children," he told himself, "for the city, for my queen. I will talk to Grey Worm," he said.
The Iron Suitor. Grief appeared alone at daybreak, her black sails stark against the pale pink skies of morning.
54.
Viterion thought sourly when they woke him.
"And she sails alone."
Silently he cursed the storm god for his malice, his rage, a black stone in his belly.
"Where are my ships?"
He had set sail from the shields with 93 of the 100 that had once made up the Iron Fleet, a fleet belonging not to a single lord, but to the Seastone Chair itself, captained and crewed by men from all the islands, ships smaller than the great war drummonds of the Greenlands, aye, but thrice the size of any common longship, with deep hulls and savage rams, fit to meet the king's own fleets in battle. In the Stepstones they had taken on grain and game and fresh water, after the long voyage along the bleak and barren coast of Dawn, with its shoals and whirlpools. There the Iron Victory had captured a fat merchant ship, the Great Cog, noble lady, on her way to Oldtown by way of Gulltown, Duskendale, and King's Landing, with a cargo of salt cod, whale oil, and pickled herring. The food was a welcome addition to their stores. 5 other prizes taken in the Red Wine Straits and along the Dornish coast. 3 cogs, a galleass, and a galley, had brought their numbers to 99. 99 ships had left the Stepstones in 3 proud fleets, with orders to join up again off the southern tip of the Isle of Cedars. 45 had now arrived on the far side of the world. 22 of Victorian's own had straggled in, by 3s and 4s, sometimes alone. 14 of Ralph the Limper's. Only 9 of those that had sailed with Red Ralph Stonehouse. Red Ralph himself was amongst the missing. To their number, the fleet had added 9 new prizes taken on the seas, so the sum was 54. But the captured ships were cogs and fishing boats, and merchantmen and slavers, not warships. In battle, they would be poor substitutes for the lost ships of the Iron Fleet. The last ship to appear had been the Maiden's Bane, 3 days previous. The day before that, 3 ships had come out of the south together, his captive noble lady lumbering along between Raven Feeder and Iron Kiss. But the day before and the day before, there had been nothing, and only Headless Jane and Fear before that. Then 2 more days of empty seas and cloudless skies after Ralph the Limper appeared with the remnants of his squadron. Lord Quellan, White Widow, Lamentation, Woe, Leviathan, Iron Lady, Reaper's Wind, and Warhammer, with 6 more ships behind, 2 of them storm-wrecked and under tow.
"Storms!"
Ralph the Limper had muttered when he came crawling to Victorian.
3 big storms and foul winds between. Red winds out of Valyria that smelled of ash and brimstone, and black winds that drove us toward that blighted shore. This voyage was cursed from the first. The crow's eye fears you, my lord. Why else send you so far away? He does not mean for us to return.
A Viterian had thought the same when he met the first storm, a day out of old Volantis.
"The gods hate kingslayers," he brooded. "Elsewise, you and Crow's Eye would have died a dozen deaths by my hand."
As the sea crashed around him and the deck rose and fell beneath his feet, he had seen Dagon's Feast and Red Tide slammed together so violently that both exploded into splinters.
"My brother's work," he thought.
Those were the first two ships he'd lost from his own third of the fleet, but not the last. So he had slapped the limper twice across the face and said,
"The first is for the ships you lost, the second for your talk of curses. Speak of that again, and I will nail your tongue to the mast. If the Crow's Eye can make mutes, so can I."
The throb of pain in his left hand made the words harsher than they might have been elsewise. But he meant what he said.
"More ships will come. The storms are done for now. I will have my fleet."
A monkey on the mast above howled derision, almost as if it could taste his frustration.
"Filthy, noisy beast."
He could send a man up after it, but the monkeys seemed to like their game, and had proved themselves more agile than his crew. The howls rang in his ears, though, and made the throbbing in his hand seem worse.
54, he grumbled.
It would have been too much to hope for the full strength of the Iron Fleet after a voyage of such length. But 70 ships, even 80, the Drowned God might have granted him that much.
"Would that we had the Damp Hair with us, or some other priest."
Viterian had made sacrifice before setting sail, and again in the Stepstones, when he split the fleet in three. But perhaps he had said the wrong prayers.
"That or the Drowned God has no power here."
More and more he had come to fear that they had sailed too far, into strange seas where even the gods were queer. But such doubts he confided only to his dusky woman, who had no tongue to repeat them. When grief appeared, Victorian summoned Wolf One Ear.
"I will want words with the Vole. Send word to Ralph the Limper, Bloodless Tom, and the Black Shepherd. All hunting parties are to be recalled. The shore camps broken up by first light. Load as much fruit as can be gathered, and drive the pigs aboard the ships. We can slaughter them at need. Shark is to remain here to tell any stragglers where we've gone."
She would need that long to make repairs. The storms had left her little more than a hulk. That would bring them down to 53. But there was no help for it.
"The fleet departs upon the morrow, on the evening tide."
"As you command," said Wolf. "But another day might mean another ship, Lord Captain."
"Aye, and 10 days might mean 10 ships, or none at all. We have squandered too many days waiting on the sight of sails. Our victory will be that much the sweeter if we win it with a smaller fleet.
And I must needs reach the Dragon Queen before the Volantines." In Volantis he had seen the galleys taking on provisions. The whole city had seemed drunk. Sailors and soldiers and tinkers had been observed dancing in the streets with nobles and fat merchants, and in every inn and wine-sink cups were being raised to the new triarchs. All the talk had been of the gold and gems and slaves that would flood into Volantis once the Dragon Queen was dead. One day of such reports was all that Victorian Greyjoy could stomach. He paid the gold price for food and water, though it shamed him, and took his ships back out to sea. The storms would have scattered and delayed the Volantines, even as they had his own ships. If fortune smiled, many of their warships might have sunk or run aground, but not all. No god was that good, and those green galleys that survived by now could well have sailed around Valyria.
"They will be sweeping north toward Meereen and Yunkai, great drummers of war, teeming with slave soldiers. If the storm guard spared them, by now they could be in the Gulf of Grief. 300 ships, perhaps as many as 500.
Their allies were already off Meereen, Yunkishmen and Astapors, men from New Giss and Karth and Tollis, and the Stormguard knew where else. Even Meereen's own warships, the ones that fled the city before its fall. Against all that, Victarion had 53, less the shark. The Crow's Eye had sailed halfway across the world, reaving and plundering from Karth to Talltree's town, calling it unholy ports, beyond where only madmen went. Euron had even braved the smoking sea, and lived to tell of it. And that with only one ship. If he can mock the guards, so can I. "Aye, Captain," said Wolf One Ear. He was not half the man that Newt the barber was, but the Crow's Eye had stolen Newt. By raising him to Lord of Oakenshield, his brother made Victarion's best man his own.
"Is it still to be Meereen? Where else the Dragon Queen awaits me in Meereen?"
"The fairest woman in the world, if my brother could be believed. Her hair is silver gold, her eyes are amethysts." Was it too much to hope that for once Euron had told it true? Perhaps. Like as not, the girl would prove to be some puck-faced satin with teats slapping against her knees, her dragons no more than tattooed lizards from the swamps of Sothorius. If she is all that Euron claims, though. They had heard talk of the beauty of Daenerys Targaryen from the lips of pirates in the Stepstones and fat merchants in Old Valantis. It might be true, and Euron had not made Victarion a gift of her. The Crow's Eye meant to take her for himself.
"He sends me, like a serving man, to fetch her. How he will howl when I claim her for myself."
Let the men mutter. They had sailed too far and lost too much for Victarion to turn west without his prize. The Iron Captain closed his good hand into a fist. "Go see that my commands are carried out, and find the maester wherever he is hiding, and send him to my cabin." "Aye," Wolf hobbled off. Victarion Greyjoy turned back toward the prow, his gaze sweeping across his fleet. Long ships filled the sea, sails furled and oars shipped, floating at anchor or run up on the pale sand shore. The Isle of Cedars. Where were these cedars? Drowned 400 years ago, it seemed. Victarion had gone ashore 12 times, hunting fresh meat, and had yet to see a cedar. The girlish maester, Euron, had inflicted upon him back in Westeros, claimed this place had once been called the Isle of 100 battles. But the men who had fought those battles had all gone to dust centuries ago. The Isle of Monkeys, that's what they should call it. There were pigs as well, the biggest, blackest boars that any of the Ironborn had ever seen, and plenty of squealing piglets in the brush, bold creatures that had no fear of man. They were learning, though. The larders of the Iron Fleet were filling up with smoked hams, salted pork, and bacon. The monkeys, though. The monkeys were a plague. Victarion had forbidden his men to bring any of the demonic creatures aboard ship, yet somehow half his fleet was now infested with them, even his own Iron Victory. He could see some now, swinging from spar to spar and ship to ship. Would that I had a crossbow! Victarion did not like this sea, nor these endless cloudless skies, nor the blazing sun that beat down on their heads and baked the decks until the boards were hot enough to scorch bare feet. He did not like these storms, which seemed to come up out of nowhere. The seas around Pike were often stormy, but there at least a man could smell them coming. These southern storms were as treacherous as women. Even the water was the wrong colour. A shimmering turquoise close to shore, and farther out a blue so deep that it was almost black. Victarion missed the grey-green waters of home, with their white caps and surges.
He did not like this Isle of Cedars either. The hunting might be good, but the forests were too green and still, full of twisted trees and queer bright flowers.